Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation with Tom Merritt and Leo Laporte. Episode 17, recorded July 6th, 2011. Gordon Bell. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Audible.com. To download the free audiobook of your choice, visit audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. And by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your new account for 6 months, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Triangulation7. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome again to another fine episode of Triangulation, the most effete intellectual show on the TWiT network. And it's primarily because of this fellow here, Mr. Tom Merritt.
What am I doing here?
He's from Texas. Tom and I actually have a great guest. Gordon Bell is going to join us.
I'm very excited about this.
Formerly of Digital Equipment Corporation. He's now a Microsoft Research Fellow and the author of a book called Total Recall.
Not the fiction book.
Not that book.
Nonfiction book.
Who wrote the science fiction Total Recall?
I Can Remember It For You Wholesale by Philip K. Dick.
Well, he's good. You can't stump this guy. So we'll get Mr. Bell on the line in just a bit to talk about all sorts of stuff. Fascinating fella. Before we do that, though, I do want to remind everybody about our fine sponsors. We've got Audible today, and we're going to talk about Gordon's book on Audible and Squarespace.com. Do I have to tell you about Squarespace? I'm sure you've heard us talk about it before. It's a secret behind exceptional websites. I take you now to squarespace.com, where you will see that great big green button. Take just a gander over there and click that green button.
Click the candy green button.
This gives you a chance to create a website and use it for 2 weeks on Squarespace. No credit card needed. In fact, you only need three things. You don't even need my name. A site name, a password, and an email address. Now, on TWiT this week, we did Brian is a Unicorn.
Right.
.squarespace.com. And within minutes...
An unicorn.
Yeah. Within minutes, this site, this Squarespace site, was created.
Yeah.
That's just how easy a beautiful site is.
Yours may be beautifuler than this one.
I love Squarespace.
But in seconds, you can create a site that complex.
It has its own soundtrack. Brian is a Unicorn. He's the Nyan Cat.
And there's a leaping...
That's a leaping jury. Justin Robert Young leaping through there in his Elvis outfit, it looked like. Colleen Kelly apparently said that it's so obviously a Photoshop because the rainbow trail is too perfect.
Mm.
So that gives it away. In any event, I mention this site so that you understand that it is easy to create even the most trivial of sites, but even the most serious of sites with Squarespace. It's hosting, best hosting there is out there, in fact, plus the software. So it's always up to date. It's always secure. Very easy to use. And you don't have to be a designer to get a site that looks like a pro did it, because they've got these great 60-plus professionally designed styles,
designers. I've been telling people, I don't know if this is okay, but I've been telling people, if you know somebody who needs a site,
that's okay.
Use Squarespace, make it, and then you can charge
them. You can charge them.
I don't know about that part,
but yeah, why not? Hell yeah.
Because they'll think you went to all this trouble, and you could, you know, hours and hours of work.
I was thinking more along the lines of, if you know somebody that has a site, you could create a site for them and give it to them, but okay.
You could do that too.
You could also charge them. Every site looks beautiful, unique, and you don't have to tell them that you use sliders, buttons, and mouse clicks to make this look so cool. By the way, if you are a CSS or a JavaScript nerd, you can do all of that too. Full style sheet code, everything. It's all available to you. This is such a nice, clean, well-designed product from some guys who really, they love you. They really love you, and they want you to be part of their love fest.
But they're not codependent. You can take your data with you when you leave.
They're not trying
to lock you in.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. They have importing from existing, and very sophisticated importing from existing blog or websites like WordPress, Movable Type Logger, and TypePad. But then you also can go the other way. You can just get it right out. So you're never stuck.
That's how confident they are you're going to like it. They're like, look, you know, we're not going to make you, we're going to force you to stay.
That's the way to do it. Social widgets that make it very easy to include your Twitter, your Facebook, and all that stuff. You see all these videos, too, by the way? Lots of tutorials, so you don't ever have to feel at sea. See how easy it is to put Flickr in there?
Like, there's Stephanie Chu.
Is that who that is?
Yeah.
Looks familiar. The Twitter. It's just fantastic. RSS of any kind. All right, I'm not going to belabor it. Go to squarespace.com. Now, here's the special extra, because we got to give you a little extra deal. A little something-something for all this. If you decide you like it, and only if you click the green button, set up a site, and decide you like it, you don't have to tell your friend this either. You'll get 10% off for the first 6 months of the site when you use the offer code TRIANGULATION7. I know that's a lot of letters, isn't it? TRIANGULATION, and the number 7. For 10% off for the first 6 months. Squarespace.com, the secret behind exceptional websites. Let's call Gordon Bell. I'm going to get him on here.
I can't decide what I want to talk to him about first.
He is...
We've got the PDPs that he worked on at DEC.
At Tech, yep.
We've got the Law of Computer Classes, Gordon Bell's Law of Computer Classes.
I don't know that.
Ask him about that.
I'll have to ask him about that.
And then of course, all the stuff he's doing at Microsoft and the life logging and everything.
It's kind of neat to see somebody, sometimes you think of computing and technology as a young man's game, and I'm an old man, and I'm glad to see that I still have a role and he has a role. We still have something to add to you whippersnappers.
Thank you.
There he is, Gordon Bell. Hey, Gordon.
Hey, can you hear me there?
I hear you great, and welcome to Triangulation. Sorry, we're running a little late here.
No problem.
Appreciate your patience. Are you coming to us from the Microsoft campus?
No, actually, I'm coming to you from my home in San Francisco.
Oh, I didn't realize you were near here.
Right.
You're smart. You live in the most beautiful town in the world.
Right, and the other half, I live in Sydney, Australia.
Really?
Wow.
Now, are you wearing around your neck, are you wearing the famous camera?
Oh, yeah.
Let's see.
I knew
that.
You might ask that, and so there it is, which is a thing called a SenseCam that we started experimenting with in about 2004.
So you're saying that SenseCam has been recording how many pictures an hour?
It records about 500 an hour.
Whoa!
So anyway, you can set it to do whatever you want.
500 an hour times 24 hours times 7 years. What are you doing? What are you doing with all those pictures?
Well, the good news is I don't really wear it that much.
Oh, good. All
right. So you're not really wearing it 24/7, huh?
Camera, and I tend to wear it. Mostly, as a camera where you want to capture a bunch of events. It's kind of a fancy movie camera in some sense.
And you wrote a book about this.
The book is there's a small facet of the book is about this, what I call ultimate life logging. That is, ultimate life logging to me is when you log in real time, you log everything. And I don't happen to subscribe to the idea that you may do that, or that you necessarily want to do it. Although I think in a decade, I think everybody's, it's very likely that we will have devices where in fact you can capture everything you hear and see and hear. We just touched on that aspect, but it was more all the other aspects of life logging that we were interested, such as what you do with health and managing everyday life and learning and all of the other things where you want to keep everything that you come through your computer and potentially meetings and the like.
So you probably would agree then with Mark Zuckerberg, who this morning observed, and I thought this seemed odd, that people, the amount of data people are sharing online is growing exponentially. He says it doubled last year, it doubles this year, it'll double next year. He says in a couple of years, we'll be sharing on average 100 bits of data about ourselves every day. It's kind of hard to imagine what those 100 bits of data could be unless you're wearing a camera that takes 500 shots an hour.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are under the impression, Gordon, that you've got this thing running 24/7. You go to the bathroom with it. You can sleep with it. You know, what in your experience?
Well, I do have some, there are some shots of some bathrooms. But on the other hand, that is a, I'd say, a mistaken impression that we really have, in the interest of honesty, I have to correct.
Now, so if we are sharing 100 bits a day of information, how much of that is important? What, and you've got some experience in this. What is the stuff that we need to be sharing? What is the stuff that we need to be recording?
Well, I think it's sort of where, in terms of the sharing aspect, it's unclear to me how much of that information you, quote, need to share. I think his comment is it will be, people will be sharing that amount. Now, that's not very much information. And, you know, it barely would have some indication of where somebody is located at, you know, during that that period.
A few times an hour. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't think I tend to think there, you know, it'll be highly skewed. There will be people who will, I'll say, be overly fastidious about sharing everything. And then there will be people like me who are much more conservative about what I want or need to share that makes it of value to anybody else. So I think the range is very great. And in fact, in life logging, we tend to warn people, just be very careful of what you do share, because that cyber landfill is very big and very deep, and people are just very good at mining the cyber landfill.
It's fairly permanent too. Yeah,
it's very permanent, and you know, we'll be in there with sort of pickaxes and instruments flying over looking for particular
data
nuggets of about personal.
So what
personal lives?
What do we
so
get out
that's
of?
That's why I say sharing it is a different animal than in fact just having it and keeping it. Now I subscribe to. Gee, it's nice if you have a track of sort of a sample track of everything you've done during the day or over your life. I think that you can always use for in some way to recall something else.
So what do we get out of doing this in the end? What's the ultimate payoff of life logging? Where are we headed with it?
Well, I think it has different payoffs for different people to. For example, this camera was used for helping people who had impaired memories. It's being used. There are several thousand of them out there where people are trying to record, recording of their life with the camera so that they can recall events. And so it's been used as sort of pre-Alzheimer cases to have that to aid in that recollection. Personally, from my point of view, the main thing that I want to recall is just this tremendous stream and interaction that you have with your colleagues about whatever, and that's just the ability to go back in time and discuss and recall whatever it was that may be relevant to the past in the future. So there's that aspect, and then there's simply the record keeping of never having anything in some other file. So I got rid of paper, for example, in 2002, and I recommend that to everybody. Although if you look at my
there's a little
My
bit of paper
here.
Behind you, yeah.
There's a bit of paper. There's some books. I basically have gotten rid of most of the books. In fact, I rarely ever have a book that's not not on you know, a Kindle or whatever electronically. And I've scanned several hundred of my books, you know, that are used as reference. That I use as reference. And so just having the books there and having your computer recollect things is just very important. So it's, I often say, I want these bits. It's not that I want the bits. My computer needs the bits to help me. So I want it to be able to have all of the bits that I have access to.
That actually, again, echoes Mark Zuckerberg today, because what he was saying is, now that we have the data, or the social graph and the data, the next thing is, what do we do with it? What's interesting? This is the big data thing. But I'm just thinking, you have about 30 million. If you had been wearing this camera for the last 7 years, you'd have about 30 million images. Part of the problem becomes retrieval. How do you use these images?
Well, I think, you know, retrieval's certainly always a big problem, and particularly the more I have, the more I'm understanding how hard the problem is, because I started by scanning all of the books, articles, everything I had written and had in my various careers. I had a lot of the files when I was head of engineering at Digital, and I scanned all of those. And so when you look for something, basically time is the big bucket that you tend to, when you get a lot of things back, you tend to use time. Thank God we've got GPS is coming in almost automatically on either cell phones or cameras. And so we've got way, you know, time and space are the big retrieval categories that people tend to use, or that at least I tend to use.
And we're definitely progressing on the ability to store more in less space.
Yeah,
as we go along.
Well, and did you coin Bell's Law, which is really more about power and space? But
Bell's Law is really an issue. What that's all about is, you know, I guess in fairness, I probably should call it a corollary to Moore's Law, which is, Moore's Law says you get more bits on a chip every year, and Bell's Law is that you, every decade, you take a small fraction of those bits that are on a chip and make smaller chips, and then use that smaller cost and size system to build a new computer platform. And so this is what got us from mainframes to mini computers to personal computers to basically to cell phones. So we get this tremendous progression in size. And in fact, there's a computer that operates now that people are embedding to understand eye pressure, and that's a millimeter cube. So it's got a battery, it's got a chip, and it's got a radio transmitter in that millimeter cube. Not very, very big. So it's a little bit bigger. I mean, it'll be a painful speck in your eye, but in fact, it is that's an example of Moore's Law of, you know, smaller and smaller chips, rather than putting a couple of centimeter chip in your on a hot plate.
So you think that camera eventually just be in your eyeball?
Exactly. Right? Yeah. Certainly, we head to those things. There are those kind of devices now. I've tried a number of the recording cameras, and they are pretty spectacular. Let's see, I was trying to think of, in fact, I have one here, which is, this is actually probably highly illegal to use. This is a,
it looks like one of those little Minox, spy cameras.
Oh yeah. Well, it's an eight gigabyte video camera.
Wow.
Here and let's see. Oh, you wear it in your pocket like, well, I don't have a pocket, but you wear it like this. The pinhole camera is here. The mic is here, right here. And it has an exceptionally high quality and does basically VHS quality recording. But it's, you know, a friend of mine who's a lawyer likes to use it so that he can be able to recall meetings and things like that. Although the place where I think you want total recall is when you visit a lawyer or when you visit a doctor and you come out of there in a bewildered state, unable to remember anything that they said to you. But you'd like to be able to recall that, those kinds of things.
I remember some years ago we did a tech TV show from the Computer Museum in Boston, which you and Gwen Bell founded some
yes.
years ago. What a great museum that is. You obviously have some interest and reverence in saving not just your own personal stuff, but also a lot of the history that you've been a big part of.
Oh, yeah. I'm delighted that you visited that.
Oh, it was so fun.
I don't know whether I sent you this paper that was a retrospective, because that is now the Computer History Museum in Mountain View.
Right.
So all of the – if you go into the wonderful new exhibit that they have there called Revolution, it's 25,000 square feet of artifacts, and a substantial number of those artifacts – we collected at the museum in Boston.
And you started in a closet? Is that right?
This was when I was head of engineering at Digital. Ken Olson, who was the president, and I had wanted to preserve some basic artifacts. I observed that the Smithsonian didn't have the proper reverence for computing, and so we started collecting some of the important MIT computers, and then started out by putting a bunch of the artifacts that we had in a small, what was formerly a coat closet, and then that moved to a wonderful lobby building in Western Massachusetts, Marlborough, Mass. Which was a building that Deck had gotten from RCA, and began the ability to sort of collect on a large scale, and then in 83 that moved to the Boston site with the Children's Museum, and that's when the main collection took place, and so we went after all of the classic computers, you know, from every, that we got. We had various Cray computers. We had DEC computers. We had Data General computers. And moving out, and then it moved out to Mountain View in 1995. And then we've been basically collecting here for 15 years. But these are more modern things, including filling out collections of other manufacturers and particularly Silicon Valley, of getting disks and getting the disk story and getting the chip story, because I mean all the chips came out of were done in the Valley, and so we wanted to get those stories and those people and those artifacts together.
There's some great stuff to see if you get to Mountain View to see that. For instance, this is you have on display a Google server rack.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
they were happy to donate, I think, one of their first ones. We have one of the first RAID drives that University of California did at Berkeley, things like that. So we've got a lot of particularly like to get the first or the prototype of something, and so we're very proactive about wanting to have these critical first devices.
Are most companies cooperative with that? I mean, I'm sure after a certain amount of time, obviously, but you know, if you in a few years go to Apple and say, "Hey, do you still have the prototype of the first iPod?" Do you think they're likely to say, "Yeah, for the Computer History Museum, sure, we'll hand that over."
Well, we have some companies are better than are much better than others about whether they have. About their history and wanting to care for those kinds of things. Apple, I think, in general, is very caring about, understands the value of those artifacts, and I particularly go out of my way anytime there's an event. I try to capture those events, and I think the biggest problem in collecting now I see is how do you collect Facebook?
Yeah, it's bits.
You know, that's these social media sites are critical to have that way, and then you've got also other things like software in general.
Do you work with Brewster Kahle and archive.org at all on that sort of thing?
Oh yeah, no, I mean I'm a great both a friend and a supporter of archive.org because he's certainly pioneered that in collecting the web or capturing the web, clocking the web. And so, in fact, right now he's scanning all of the computer museum, the Boston Computer Museum's reports where we basically the first sort of 18 machines, the very first computer. So we have Eckert and Mockley, ENIAC. We've got all of those stories that were captured on tape or videotape. From Atanasoff to Zeus. So we've got this wide range of pioneers that was probably the most important thing that we did at Digital, and that was to get all of these guys before they died, and we missed a few. But getting those first pioneers and getting their stories was really an important part of the museum and the collection.
It's funny, I share your interest in that. When we were at Tech TV, one of the things I really tried to do is get to talk to as many of the people like Doug Engelbart and so forth.
Oh yeah,
while you could to record this history, because I think it's really easy when you're in the middle of history not to realize the impact of and the import of what's going on and just kind of take it for granted. And things are happening so fast in Silicon Valley, and it's such a radical transformation of culture and society that I think it's really important to record all of this.
Especially those first things that you're talking about,
yeah. Gordon,
where at the time you just think, well, let's get rid of this old crap because we want to upgrade and get new. And then you realize way later, well, there was some significance to that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's something I feel very strongly about, that you do capture all of those, and so I go out of my way to make sure that we're doing that. And we've got having the cadre of volunteers that we have at the museum, they help, and so we cast a very wide net of here that is interested in the collecting around. Everything from we have an operating now, an operating full scale 1401. So we have a 1401 with discs and tapes and printers and everything working as it lived. Similarly, we have a PDP-1 that is operating. And so there's a very active community here that likes to get this old stuff working, and to me it's just wonderful and amazing too. So we tend to record those as they operate in the latest form.
I'm looking at the PDP-1 restoration project. You can actually play Space War in your browser with Java, which I think is hysterical.
The first video game. No, that's the way it should be. We ought to be able. I think the role of the museum and I'll say the community that's interested in history is to make sure that we can run every damn machine that's ever, every significant machine that's ever been, you know, every from the PET to the Commodore to the English computer, the one that they used
you better teach me how to play Space War, Gordon.
Oh yeah, watch it going right into the sun. See, you just saw that. Now, the idea is to have enough thrust so that you don't you're going in there. Ah! Right? Yeah, you better turn it around and get out. Well, there.
This was a vector based game. I think the first video game.
Yeah, actually, It wasn't vector at all. Those spaceships, those are all dots.
Those are dots on a screen, on a cathode ray tube.
That's 1,000 by 1,000 point plotting display.
Wow!
And it took every point took about 30 microseconds. So there, and in fact, in back of that, if they did it right, and I can't exactly tell from here, but the star table is behind that. So the guys who built it put in the star table, and the stars are so gradually
moving. Huh?
Star field moves.
I think it is.
Yeah, but it's and the lovely thing is that the principal guy who developed it, Steve Russell, is a docent at the Computer History Museum.
Oh, that's great.
So you can get the full boat of what it's all about. Just going there and seeing, meeting some of these guys who've actually done it, is really wonderful too.
Well, thank you for doing the Computer History Museum. I'm just glad that it's still around and you're preserving all this stuff. And
no, it's doing very well. It has a lot of support, and we're just anxious to keep this, collect it and tell the stories. And you see a lot of business in there. When, for example, if you look at go in one of the galleries, for example, the mini computer gallery. There were 95 mini computer companies.
Digital was one.
We
Data General. They were all on 128.
Longer than most, with every generation, it becomes easier and easier to build a variety, of the machine. So in the mainframes, there were only 10 or so mainframe companies, and then with PCs, at least because of the way the PCs kind of fabricated and with boards and stuff, why there's literally thousands of different companies kind of branding different forms of PCs.
You actually have a theory of computer evolution.
Yeah, This is really it's all having to do with Bell's law and the fact that these machine classes form. You have to have a new class has to have a new network. It has to have a new platform. It has to have a new set of users and uses. And then an industry starts forming around that. I mean, everything you can see that happening now, as we speak. We've seen it with the smartphones, as they've happened, and then also it's coming around with the iPad, and then the iPad knockoffs, as a new device. Namely, it's a cloud supported device. It requires the cloud, and it also requires the fact that it's a different kind of use. And so It basically is a reading device. I mean, in a way, Kindle was kind of the first of to recognize that, and then it also goes back to Microsoft's tablet TV and our tablet. We didn't recognize the tablet as what it was because it was built too big. It was a PC that had a tablet interface, and now
it was a laptop they ripped the keyboard off of.
Yeah, right. And these devices are really quite different. And mainly, it's all about weight and screen resolution and battery life and all of that that make it a different device. And then also a whole set of apps that are. I mean, who would have thunk? 100,000 apps, the number of different apps, the way the software is delivered to these things, these devices is just outstanding.
Now you say we get a new class about every decade. Was the smartphone last decade and the tablet the one we're headed into?
I tend to think this. Ray Ozzie says we're getting them now more frequently, every 5 years. Mm. And so, I mean, and so in that basis, why the smartphone was quite, I don't know, we can put that at maybe 2005 or in that period. And then, the tablet is really quite quite different, but, although people do use, smartphones for reading, as readers, but
yeah, there's some crossover between those two classes.
Yeah, but I think in fact we've got that is a 5 year. That's a much more rapid evolution than the theory necessarily calls for. But they are they definitely are newer and different.
What do you think we're going to get after tablets?
The one I've been advocating for a long time is the whole business of wireless sensor nets, sort of, ubiquitous things that, sensing devices and the like that are, you might even look at those as computer peripherals. You know, things like I've got a Fitbit here, but devices that have to do with health monitoring and sensing. So I think that those kind of devices I've been expecting those to explode, but. The biggest problem there is actually the difficulty of getting them to connect to something, some other system. You know, we keep wanting, quote, the smart grid and all that, but the big problem with the smart grid is at your home site, at your home, is how do you get the smartness to go and flick the light switch, because that requires an installation problem. And the more people can figure out how to get rid of that, to make that get around the installation problem, why that then smart grids will be more useful. But I think this sensing stuff is a big deal. I mean, for example, our Kinect. If you could figure out using those in around the house or in fact anywhere, then just the ability to use that as gestures as an interface to accomplish whatever you want to do looks like that will be important. So I think those things are upon us. I think you guys are, in fact, right here, are pioneering this whole business of moving video, having low cost video that makes video a respectable, ubiquitous you know, connection. So I think you're pioneering. You're clearly pioneering here.
There's so much new stuff, Gordon. It'd be hard not to be a pioneer if you're working in technology in any way.
It's wonderful.
It's
Isn't
all
it great?
New.
Never felt better.
Yeah, it's exciting. Well, I'm thinking back. You got your master's in 1957 in electrical engineering from MIT. You worked. You designed early PDPs. You oversaw the development of the VAX. So, and I'm thinking now, probably it's very likely that this little cell phone in my hand probably has more power than the most powerful VAX.
Oh yeah, you can't even compare them. I mean,
yeah, I mean, and that thing was huge. That took up a wall in a room and it had to be refrigerated. So it's in a human lifetime, and it's amazing how fast and how quickly it's changing, and it is exciting, isn't it, to be part of it?
Yeah, I think that one of the things the museum does very well is it basically tells that story of progress, and people can get those ideas. But anyway, it's something that anybody who's uses a computer has an appreciation for a computer should. Will have to visit in their lifetime.
Oh, that's amazing. You worked on speech synthesis early on.
I did. I worked on when I was in MIT. When I was I abandoned a quest for a doctorate when I joined Digital Equipment Corporation as an engineer. I got out of speech after a year of work. Simply because I said this is really science, and I'm an engineer, and it's going to take 20 years before we make any progress on speech. And
make it 50 years,
40 years.
Yeah,
40 to make. And actually, it's been close. It's really 50 before we've actually got reasonable. What I would say, reasonable speech interface.
Well, think about it. You've got in that Kindle, you've got a little bot that can read the book.
Oh yeah,
fairly well.
In fact, in 1980, we bought the synthesis software from MIT and a thing called DeckTalk. And if you even today, you'll find a lot of DeckTalk still in existence when you see this kind of Swedish accent speaker.
Computers that talk like this.
it's undoubtedly a DeckTalk device or software running.
Yeah, the Kindle is not only it can do speech, it can do cloud computing.
Right.
Because it pulls its information. It's got a browser in there, and it downloads the books. It's got a constant connection. It's part of that. It's almost part of that sensor network you're talking about. It's playing in lots of fields.
Yeah, the sensor, it's critical to have that link to make with the cloud, because the cloud gives you infinite power there.
I got to give you some Gordon Bell quotes. This is one of my favorites. When you were working at Digital, the most reliable components are the ones you leave out. They never break, do they?
They don't break. Yeah.
But you are the guy, and a son later made a lot of hay with this, but you are the guy who said, I think one of the most prescient things of all, and this is back in 82, the network becomes the system. This is very early on in networking, but you already saw what was going to happen. The network, and of course, Sun later said the network is the computer.
Yeah, right. They certainly preempted that.
Yeah. But
post-empted it, I guess.
Yeah, post-empted it. Stole it. Let's call a spade a spade.
Right.
Appropriated.
And for a long time, I didn't even understand what Sun meant when they said the network is the computer. But of course, now I think we do understand.
Sure.
With the widespread use of the internet. That's it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was. I said that at the introduction of the Ethernet.
Okay.
which I've got to say was probably one of the most fun things that I ever did. Which was I was there were three of us that introduced the Ethernet, and that was Dave Liddell from Xerox, and me from Digital, and then Bob Noyce from Intel.
Yeah.
So I had the wonderful opportunity to be with Bob there, and then also we introduced it in London and gave we sort of had a roadshow where we talked about Ethernet and how important we thought that was going to be. And so and Ethernet is, and I think I also said at that point, Ethernet is the UART of the 80s, but actually it's turned out to be true that in fact it certainly replaced the RJ11 phone connection as the way everything is connected.
So tell us what you meant when you said the network becomes the system.
Okay, at that point, it really has to do with the business of taking components that might have been just components and or separate computers, and then aggregating them together to form what is now a system, a cloud system. So it had to do with cloud. It has to do with how you cluster, how you aggregate computers to make another computer. So today we aggregate on the order of, maybe 100 in some cases 100,000 computers, and we think of that is a computer. But in reality, they've all got their own independent program counters. They all operate independently. But in fact, when you put them together by having this network, that becomes the system or the computer. So it's really a kind of, iterative and recursive statement that as you aggregate the components, then they in fact become the system again. So when I thought of it, when it was done at the time, I saw, I had a similarity between how we had used a bus to connect computer components like disks and tapes and printers and the like. And then in the case of Ethernet, then in fact, we did the same thing, although each of the components were then separated and put in a different computer and distributed over space, and then that whole thing you think of as a single computer. So it's sort of the breaking apart of the computer to constantly form a computer. So the whole world is just a collection of computers aggregated in different ways to behave as one or many.
I found on computerhistory.org the program from that event and your remarks here about the network becoming the system. I'm so glad that somebody archives this stuff, including this picture of, I think, of you somewhere in here, if I can find it. It's really fun to look at this. And this is at the introduction, let's say it again, of Ethernet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wrap your head around that one.
Ethernet can eliminate this complexity while be providing the flexibility and need for future growth. It's
just like FireWire, USB, or Thunderbolt.
Mm. Yeah.
Ethernet had to have its moment where it was pushed. You had to get people to adopt.
That's right.
It seems incredible to think about that now when
it's pervasive. Yeah. It's pervasive.
The thing that makes it significant is we were all able to adopt it, and that was that whole story is so interesting in terms of when we were doing it, I was able to persuade Xerox to make that a free license. If we hadn't been able to make it make it sort of a zero-cost license, I think it would have gotten in the way. Everything, Xerox would have had to license everybody. And I look at that as Xerox is probably one of the biggest contributions Xerox has made to the world has been that opening up of that license.
Before we even talked, you know, in terms of open or proprietary, that was a very early case of openness and
yeah.
a clearly made a huge difference.
Yeah, it wasn't an IEEE.
Oh, yeah, it wouldn't have. I think we would have been fighting with different standards there. I mean, it might have ultimately settled out to one, but having it that way and just made it a kind of a no-brainer, and that's why we made the deal. Wanted to make the deal with the Intel so that the chips were available,
right?
And people could easily make make systems from them.
Well, Mr. Bell, we owe you so much, and I'm so grateful for the time we've had today to talk to you, and for the contribution you've made and are continuing to make. And that must be very gratifying to you to be able to continue in this field.
Just staying on is great. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, it's just fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us, and I hope we could talk again very soon. We are out of time now, unfortunately.
Okay, well, hey, yeah, I'll say call me at any time.
We will. We'll have you back soon.
If you're ever up in Petaluma, drop by.
Yeah, you're not so far away. Okay. Please come in. We'll show you the new studio, which has a lot of Ethernet. A lot of Ethernet.
Yeah.
$20,000 worth of Ethernet Cat 6 cable.
RJ45s.
So. Yeah, it's all over there. Nice. I do appreciate your time. Thank you so much, Mr. Bell.
Okay.
Take care.
Hey, it's been a lot of fun.
Gordon Bell. What a fascinating subject. And if you can go to the Computer History Museum in Mountain View.
Absolutely.
It's a must-see. It's an amazing, 100% amazing
recommend
place.
It. Yeah.
All right.
And thanks for working on Vax. I did a little Vax VMS.
Did you really?
The Slavic Library at the University of Illinois.
Oh, wonderful. I'm delighted to hear that.
And you know what? Okay. You know what two Vaxes are called? Vaxin.
Vaxin, yes.
That's true. Absolutely. I wouldn't make it up. Thank you, Gordon.
Thanks, Gordon.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Gordon Bell. And, you know, this My Life Bits project, which is his kind of current project, is fascinating. I want to point you to an Audible book of his, Total Recall, How the E-Memory Revolution Will Change Everything. It came out last year and is a fascinating read. And I want to give it to you for free right now. In fact, if you are not yet an Audible member, you can go to audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. Sign up for the gold account. That's a book a month. Your first month is free. Your first book is free. You can cancel it any time. So it costs you nothing, and it's yours to keep forever. This is an example of where Audible can be a place where you learn as well as be entertained. There's just an endless resource of fantastic books. I thought you'd be interested in this, Tom. Zombie Fest.
No, I know.
On.
Yeah, I got the email about that.
knowing your love for zombies,
I do have a little zombie.
Yeah,
anymore.
Of course, Gary Vaynerchuk's book, "The Thank You Economy," is out and on audio now. I really love what he says about that. There's, you know, this is just such a great place to go if you spend time in the car, at the gym, washing dishes, doing errands, working in the garden. There's plenty of time in the day to read. You may not even know
you'll
about
have a
it.
Cleaner house,
and you'll have a fuller mind. I love Audible. I want you to try right now, audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. We thank Audible so much for supporting this, which I think is our most important show, frankly, on the network, because we talk to people like Gordon Bell. And, you know, I don't know if I really did him justice when we introduced him. I should have started by saying, here's the guy who designed the PDP, who designed the Vax. I mean, this guy, Ethernet.
Introduced Ethernet.
Is truly a legend in the business. And is truly beloved by everybody who meets him. I've met him several times, and I just think he's
he's done so much, and he hasn't stopped.
And I'm very serious in this. I love it seeing somebody continue in their career doing this into old age, because as I quickly approach old age, I don't want to stop.
Yeah.
We are in the most exciting field in the world, and to be able to watch what's happening.
And he's not just like, well, I'm still working on Ethernet refining it. No, he's doing life logging.
Yes.
He's doing brand new stuff, blazing
he's really
trails.
Thinking
really,
about
it's really
this
impressive.
Stuff. Yep. So we thank you for joining us to meet Gordon Bell. I hope you enjoyed that interview, and we'll have him back. We still owe Captain Crunch, by the way, another segment.
That's right.
We've got to work on that. Who's coming up, Chad Johnson, on future episodes? You don't have to pull up a mic. You can just tell me, and I'll.
Dr. Nicole Lee.
The brain monkey. Are you kidding
She's not a brain monkey.
We've got a brain monkey coming on?
She works on controlling monkey brains?
No, they're reading monkey thoughts.
Monkey thoughts on our next triangulation. Is that really next week?
No, that's not next
week. What's next week? Do you know?
We're still working
on it. We may not have a show next week.
No, we will, because Chad is committed to making sure we have a show every week this month.
Next week, Chad Johnson.
When's the monkey brain lady?
We're working on
In July? 22nd. So she'll be the last triangulation in the old building. Mm-hmm. And then do we know who's going to be on the 29th? Actually, it won't be the 29th. It'll be the 20th, something like that.
27th.
Brie Pettis.
Oh, Brie.
Brie Pettis.
MakerBot.
He should bring his MakerBot in because we'll have room in the new studio.
He
can actually print.
He's an expectant father, too.
Is he?
Yeah.
Oh, that's exciting.
He's making a baby.
So,
I mean,
not with his MakerBot.
Not with the MakerBot.
Hey, coming up in just a bit, we're a little late. Sorry about that, Mr. Kirk Harnack. It's This Week in Radio Technology. We do this show every weekday, well, almost every Wednesday, here at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern at live.twit.tv. That's 2300 UTC for those of you watching around the world. We do hope you'll join us live, but if you can't, you can always get a copy of the show, both audio and video, available at twit.tv/TRI for triangulation. Tom Merritt, we'll see you tomorrow, 2:30 Pacific, 5:30 Eastern.
Every day.
For TNT Tech News Today. Thanks for coming in early today to cover the Facebook
announcement. I like doing that stuff. I like covering those announcements.
The show is produced by Eileen Rivera and now Chad Johnson. And we're very happy to have Chad aboard. He's getting us lots of wonderful people. And we thank you for being here. We'll see you next time on Triangulation.
Adios.